Why was the original Penn Station built only to be torn down some 50 years later? We find out the answer to that question in the first half of today's Writer's Voice, when we talk with Paul Kaplan about his book, New York's Penn Station, The Rise and Fall of an American Landmark. Then a novel slash memoir about one man's grandparents during the Holocaust. We speak with Bram Presser about The Book of Dirt. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. And do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. At its opening in 1910, New York's Penn Station was seen as one of the most beautiful railroad stations in the world. And it wasn't just beautiful, it was an engineering marvel. After decades of looking for a way to connect passengers directly to Manhattan, the Pennsylvania Railway accomplished what few had imagined could be done, building tunnels underneath the Hudson and East Rivers. Paul Kaplan's book, New York's Penn Station, The Rise and Fall of an American Landmark, chronicles the story of that magnificent building from the laying of the first tracks to its demise when it was torn down. The historic preservation movement was born in no small part as a reaction to its demolition. Paul Kaplan, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
This book, New York's original Penn Station, it's just a fascinating look into the history of what was an amazing building. And, you know, as you say, the rise and tragic fall of an American landmark. First of all, why is it called Penn Station instead of a Union Station or Manhattan Station?
So the station was owned by the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, and so it was named Penn Station accordingly. And we should note that at the time, that was the largest company in the United States and one of the largest employers. It had enormous clout. So that's why it's named such.
So talk about the power of the railroad industry at the turn of the 20th century.
So after the Civil War, the nation begins to rebuild. And with the advent of technology and the Industrial Revolution, suddenly there's this huge need to transport a lot of goods as the country starts to open up and the railroads are finally built in the 1870s and the 1880s and into the end of the 19th century. With the oil, you have a need to, of course, transport that. And with coal and the increase in production of coal, there's a huge need to transport that as well. So a lot of the so-called robber barons really got in on this capitalization, like Vanderbilt being a primary among them, in putting down tracks. And with the railroads, it actually became quite cutthroat in terms of different railroads kind of one-upping each other. There was a lot of underhanded and secret rebates with manufacturers to try to get ahead. And sort of in the thick of all that, you have the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, which owned a lot of railroads, trying to really make its claim, especially in terms of reaching Manhattan.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the robber barons. You know, we are now in what's called the Second Gilded Age. That was the First Gilded Age. But the Pennsylvania Railroad Company was a kind of different kind of corporation than those that were headed by robber barons like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, and different than the ones that are typical today. As you point out, this was a private endeavor that sought to provide a public good at great risk.
Absolutely. And I think there's a few important points. So one is, while the railroad industry was predominant, it definitely had a lot of highs and lows subject to economic cycles. So with the Panic of 1893, for example, you start to get a decrease in demand for transportation, and there's almost an overbuilt railway system. And a lot of these railway companies start to have some economic issues and take on a lot of losses. Now, with the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, I think some of it comes down to really excellent leadership. And one of the key leaders during this period was Alexander Cassatt, who was the brother of the famed Impressionist painter Mary Cassatt. And Alexander Cassatt is really one of those great business leaders who has a vision, who is trying to produce something of great value for his company and his shareholders, but also for the public good. Cassatt feels almost bad about some of these underhanded deals that are going on in the railroad industry and a lot of the kickbacks. And he wants his company to kind of rise above that. And he's rather imaginative with some of the architects that whom he hires in trying to build something that would, what he thought would stand for the ages, a station. And also the technology, the engineering feat, like this idea of having a tunnel underneath the Hudson River or East River is something that would have scarcely been imagined at the time. So he wanted to do that. And he also wanted to improve the Tenderloin District, which is where Penn Station is even today, and take this very seedy, kind of downtrodden, scam-prone area and make it something better. So one takeaway is this was a rare example of a great public and private partnership.
How was it a public partnership? Because it was entirely done with private money.
It was entirely done with private money. It was a partnership in the sense that Cassatt did, it wasn't just about the Pennsylvania Railroad Company's shareholders. He also did want to improve the lives of commuters who took the Pennsylvania Railroad so they wouldn't have to take a ferry when they reached New Jersey, that they would actually be able to go all the way into Manhattan, to improve the neighborhood where the Penn Station was built. There's a lot of documents talking about some of that urban renewal. So private money, private company, looking after their customers as any business needs to, but with a little bit of an eye towards the public good as a result, which was more than we tended to see from Vanderbilt and Grand Central Station.
So tell us a little bit more about why they wanted to build a station to New York City. You know, how come that hadn't happened before? What was facing commuters when they tried to get to New York City from the New Jersey side?
So commuters would take the railroad from wherever they were starting from to really New Jersey. And they had this sort of arduous task ahead of them where they'd have to get off the train, transport all their bags, take a ferry in the rather crowded Hudson River and take the ferry into Manhattan. It would typically embark in lower Manhattan. It was this very kind of chaotic scene that they would have to deal with when they came over. And it was an unpleasant journey, and it probably suppressed some of the consumer demand as well. We should also point out on the East River, in terms of coming in from Long Island by any train to Manhattan, would also have been very difficult, because the only thing that we really had at this point in the late 19th century was Grand Central and its railway station, which would go towards Westchester and through the Bronx. Why hadn't this been done before? This actually was thought of by the Pennsylvania Railroad Company for quite a while. A lot of presidents of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company wrestled with this question. How will we be able to cross seamlessly the Hudson River or East River? It was largely engineering difficulties why they didn't. Even though they identified that as a problem for their company and for their customers, it would be very difficult to actually solve for that. You have to remember, it would not be considered safe to go like under a tunnel underwater. The notion of having tunnels that would be able to withstand the enormous weight of the trains would be something that would be very difficult to come engineering-wise. Another piece to this is risk. So, you know, a lot of corporate leaders weigh any perceived benefit versus risk. And the few presidents that preceded Cassatt thought that this would be a great problem to solve. But on the other hand, I don't want a huge accident in terms of the tunnels. I don't want workers who are dying as a result of it. And I'm not sure that it's truly worth the benefit. And then the other thing is a lot of them put a lot of their ideas into building a bridge and sort of like this co-optation that different railroads would participate in to build a bridge that the railway could go over the Hudson River. But that plan fell apart and it never really worked.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Kaplan about his book, New York's Original Penn Station, The Rise and Tragic Fall of an American Landmark. Now, tell us about the star-studded architectural team that Alexander Cassatt hired, McKim, Mead, and White.
A perfect adjective that you use. It was star-studded. McKim, Mead, and White had done a lot of buildings throughout New York City. The Harvard Club, for example, today is a good example. And they were an interesting trio. They all, each one kind of brought something to the table. White wanted to bend the rules. He was about pushing the envelope. And you had McKim, who was really kind of imagining different possibilities with architecture. And then you had Mead, who was more business-minded and had sort of dotted the I's and crossed the T's for the company. So Cassatt decided to hire this company because even though they didn't have experience in building a real railroad station, so it was an unlikely choice, they weren't real experts in terms of engineering and how do you develop a station that's going to be able to accommodate that. He wanted someone who could really think beyond the norm. And he was impressed with a lot of the buildings that he saw that they built. And he developed a pretty close collegial business relationship, particularly with Charles McKim. And so McKim had the task of building this grandiose, almost ancient Rome in your backyard station, but never really had that experience in doing it. So one thing that McKim did is he drew on some of what he had seen on vacations that he took like a year or two prior to him having this assignment. And two monuments in Europe that very much influenced the station were one, the Gare d'Orsay in Paris, that train station, that whole notion of how trains could go in and out of the station and in terms of the tunneling, and which is still there today as a museum. And then the second, which McKim drew on, which is still there today in terms of runes, was the Baths of Caracalla in Rome, which is just about a 5-minute walk from the Colosseum. And what struck McKim in seeing the Baths of Caracalla was how they were laid out, how the passageway in the baths to go to the various thermal waters and the cold water, how that sort of walkway laid out is what he used in his design of the Penn Station. And I should add, is also what's used for Union Station in Chicago.
Now, in order for them to get the permits, which can be a nightmare in New York City even today, and to, you know, even buy up the land around that, they had to combat Tammany Hall. So tell us about Tammany Hall. This was, which had New York City in its corrupt grip.
Absolutely. Very, very well said. So we have to remind ourselves that for a few decades before they're even trying to build Penn Station, Tammany Hall really was like the grist political machine of New York City. It would often take a lot of immigrants under its wing in exchange for votes. And there was a lot of corruption, bribery, kickbacks. We should note, though, that the picture is a little more complex than that. So a lot of some of the New York City public liked Tammany Hall because they were not about kind of like these theoretical political ideas, but rather about solving concrete problems. So you're an immigrant from Ireland and you are having trouble finding a job. We're going to help you find a job. We're going to send you a dinner. So this is a group that you're going to be loyal to. and definitely will give your votes to, or they may even sort of be forced to do that. By the time this comes around in the early 20th century, Tammany Hall's tactics kind of lose some steam. This is the heart of the Progressive Era, which we talk about as being 1890 to 1920, whereby there were a lot of reforms. Tammany Hall couldn't just kind of send these dinners and find jobs in exchange for a lot of political favors, but began to change how they did business. But they still were very much part of the corruption. So with that said, when they were building Penn Station, they were choosing a contractor, the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, and they get a visit from a certain engineering company who makes it very clear that this company needs to be selected. And if they're not selected, then it's going to be a real problem. There's going to be all kinds of bureaucracy. They'll make their lives very difficult, but very operationally. So it put this company in sort of a bind. Like, do you play ball with Tammany Hall and hire who they want, or do you go it alone but risk what can happen?
And so how do they solve this?
Well, some of whom they hire were connected with Tammany Hall, and some of the subcontractors weren't, but some of it was done in partnership with engineering companies that worked with them.
And now, talk about the Tenderloin District. You already mentioned it, but you know, this was a huge haul. We're talking going from 31st to 33rd Street, a huge hole in the neighborhood that had to be created to build this station. 31st to 33rd Street, 7th Avenue to 8th Avenue. What kind of neighborhood was it? How was the displacement handled? And you write that it was the largest African-American community in Manhattan at that time. Where did people go?
So before they started building the station, in secret, the Pennsylvania Railroad Company tried to find the right location for the station. This would have been a very unlikely choice, that neighborhood that you just outlined, because it was considered very seedy, very corrupt. It was kind of like a low rent district. There were a lot of gambling joints. There's a lot of illegal prostitution. And there were tourists who went there, but it was known also for having a lot of scams. And it was also a place of great corruption because a lot of the police, again, quintessentially Tammany Hall, would turn a blind eye to a lot of what they saw for being paid off. So why was it called the Tenderloin District in the first place? Because the policeman, Clubber, William Clubber, who was assigned to this beat, said, I may have been just having regular meat for my dinner when I wasn't earning very much before, but now that I'm assigned to this district, I'm going to get so much extra money from these bribes, I'm going to have like a tenderloin steak. So that's like a paraphrase of it. And that's how it became to know as the Tenderloin District, because it was so corrupt. So in a way, it took a lot of courage for the Pennsylvania Railroad Company to choose this because they would have to deal with that. And then another thing is, it was not necessarily a desirable place if you were a commuter that you would want to get out of. Or this might be your first entry into Manhattan if you were a traveler. Because remember, when they were envisioning Pennsylvania Railroad Station, sure, they thought about commuters, but a lot of what they thought about was the long distance traveler. So you can imagine reaching Manhattan, coming out in this area, this would be your first impression. So they thought, though, that it was cheap, it was economically feasible, and also there was a little bit of they thought they could improve it, and they also thought of competition with Vanderbilt's Grand Central Station, which was built in Nowersville when it first was built. And it first starts in 1871, and then a new one was built in the early 20th century, and what we have now is 1913. So the Pennsylvania Railroad Station hires a real estate company to buy the property of the Tenderloin District from individual owners in secret. The sellers have no idea why they're selling it, because otherwise the price would obviously shoot up. This goes on for a while. somehow it's leaked to the press a little bit. So then some sellers start to be suspicious about why they're buying these properties. But no one really knew exactly what they were doing, even if they thought there might be some kind of station. I don't think they knew the magnitude of what it would be, and certainly not in terms of all the tunnels that were built. So they buy it. And in some cases, they do try to use eminent domain because some sellers do refuse. And so I found in some of the Pennsylvania Railroad archives certain suits that are brought about in terms of eminent domain, in terms of lawyers that are trying to settle with the sellers, and many of them kind of relocate. This also was a very big African-American community. There were some historically significant clashes with some of the African-Americans and some of the police, nothing to do with Penn Station, but just in terms of what was happening in that neighborhood when it was being built. In terms of when they built this big hole, as you said, well, it was like having ancient Rome in your backyard, and yet it was like this downtrodden area. So it was like this period of wonder, of curiosity, and also a little bit of danger, because there would be like sort of flying objects that would be coming from the construction of it, you know, which I read about.
Now, talking about the making of this, I mean, you mentioned before the tunnel was an engineering feat. I mean, it just incredible descriptions of, you know, how they started on both sides of the Hudson and they had to meet in the middle. And, you know, when they finally met, it was only an eighth of an inch off from one side to the other side, which was phenomenal. But the conditions of labor, they were horrendous. Talk about them and the Sandhogs.
The Sandhogs were the men, because they were all men, who were taking on the arduous and laborious and dangerous job, which we rarely think about, even though we use it every day, who would go under the water of the Hudson River or the East River and actually work on the tunnels. Now, this job was extremely difficult for a few reasons. One is in terms of just the great weight in terms of the tunnels and advancing the shields to build the tunnels, because without that, there would be all this debris that would be coming at you, as well as covering up all the work you're doing to try to clear for the tunnel. Another thing is, in order for this project to be successful, and the stakes were so high, and I think this is a really important point, we're talking about massive injuries. If the tunnels did not align correctly, the trains would have sank. And not to mention the Pennsylvania Railroad Company would be liable and would, you know, the stock would tank. So we have to think about it in terms of the enormous business risks and personal risks that were taken in terms of building the tunnels. Now, the other thing for the Sandhogs, besides the great danger in building the tunnels and eventually connecting them and not knowing if they would ever connect, was the very feared bends. So this is a condition that when you're underwater and you're breathing in a certain way, if you rise to the surface too quickly, it could be a very painful condition that can cause paralysis and even death. And because it's so painful, someone who's afflicted by it would often be bent over to try to nullify some of the pain. And that's why it's called the bends. Now, we should point out that the Pennsylvania Railroad really tried a lot of things to minimize or negate the bends. So there were very strict rules about how you would go down and when you would come up, what that would be like. They had certain baths of certain temperature. There were rules like you couldn't go on an empty stomach, rules about smoking. And so they were able to have a lot fewer deaths than normal. And another thing that the Sandhogs had to worry about was blowouts. So this would happen when the pressure that in the space that they were in was not aligned to a pressure nearby, and it would cause this blowout. And that was very, very dangerous. And that happened. And there are actually stories of ferries, passengers on ferries just casually going across the Hudson River or East River and being shocked to see this huge geyser of water, which was a blowout. And unfortunately, there were some deaths that ensued from that as well.
Yeah, there were a few hundred people who died, all told.
Yes.
So now this incredible neoclassical structure gets built at, you know, the cost of hundreds of lives, millions of dollars. Then it gets torn down in the mid-1960s after only 52 years of existence. Why?
And that's one of the great tragedies of it. So it did have a great run when it was built in the first decade. It was partly seized by the government during World War I. The 1920s was probably the golden age of it. That was the Roaring Twenties in New York, and there was a great demand to ride it. And it was very glamorous. And it was the way that you would travel long distance. During the Depression, it does start to decline. And the Pennsylvania Railroad Company is reluctant in the late 30s and 40s to put in the money to make it shiny and restore some of its glory. But it's still hanging in there. Well, by the late 50s, with the advent of the airplane and the automobile, so the automobile, as we know, comes for the average consumer in the 1950s. That is, it was not something that was just among, you know, a certain part of the population. So this greatly affects even more the long distance travel. You have some of the commuters, and you have a great deal of business from the Long Island commuting. But the Pennsylvania Railroad Company believes that it's not enough, even with the freight business, with the commuter business. They're not making the profits that they feel they need to. And so in the early 1960s, they look for partnerships. And eventually, they find this opportunity with Madison Square Garden. So they think about this idea of selling their air rights, of taking down what they have and making it this very utilitarian but more profit-making station, and that they would revenue share in some of the Madison Square Garden games and so on. It didn't work, even on a business level, because even though they did this and they tore down one of the most beautiful stations, they eventually had to merge with what was once Vanderbilt Central Railway, and it all declared bankruptcy just a few years later anyway, by the late 1960s. They also tore it down. I think it's important to point out there was not the landmarking laws that we have today. There was not really many protests about it, too. Sure, there was a little bit. There were one or two groups that had some protests with signs about saving Penn Station, but they were so outnumbered. And the zeitgeist of the early 1960s was not about historical preservation, like in some ways it is today. It was very much about sort of out with the old and in with the new, make it slick. There wasn't the same appreciation, and there wasn't the legal standing. We should note that it was from Penn Station's death, if you will, in a way that saved Grand Central, because it brought a lot of awareness to that historic preservation and a lot of laws that wound their way up the court system and ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court, that the city of New York prevailed. And that gave standing to a lot of the landmarking laws.
Wow. Well, this is just a fascinating history, Paul Kaplan. And it's been fascinating to talk with you about your book, New York's Original Penn Station, The Rise and Tragic Fall of an American Landmark. Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Paul Kaplan is the author of several historical books, including a biography of the pioneering social and healthcare reformer Lillian Wald. We spoke with him about that book last year. Next up, a novel that's also a memoir, tracing the author's family history during the Holocaust. We talk with Bram Presser about The Book of Dirt. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations, extended interviews, and transcripts. When Bram Presser was growing up in Australia, he knew his grandparents had been born in Czechoslovakia and sent to concentration camps during the Holocaust. But it was something they never talked about. Then, After his grandfather's death, as you'll learn during our interview with Presser, something happened that set him on the trail to learn more. He embarked on a quest to find the truth behind the stories his family built around these remarkable survivors. And he began writing. But the record was sketchy, so what emerged has elements of fiction as well as memoir. In The Book of Dirt, Bram Presser reimagines his family's experiences from the fragments he uncovered, creating a powerful novel about memory, history, and identity. The Book of Dirt won the 2018 National Jewish Book Award Goldberg Prize for debut fiction. Well, Bram Presser, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, The Book of Dirt, it's called a novel, but it's really much more than that. It's really a kind of genre-bending memoir, fiction, family story. And what you call it is your story, woven from the threads of rumor and legend. Tell us about that, your approach to this book.
You know, it's kind of, it came about quite organically. I was just looking to find my grandparents' stories. They were survivors of the Holocaust who never told their story. And, you know, a few years after they died, this article was published about my grandfather. So I started tracking down their stories. And I was just doing it for my own, I was very close with them when they were alive. And I felt I wanted to finally know them now that the opportunity had arisen. And so I was just kind of tracking it down as a personal quest, I suppose. And I was just keeping notes. It wasn't really intended to be a book. But it became apparent very early that there just weren't records and there weren't people willing to speak. And, you know, those that might have been were dead. So I started thinking about them as fictional characters and writing it that way from the bits that I had started to pick up. And then in a kind of strange organic way, information became available as I was writing. And so I was having this strange kind of bouncing off of the recreation of their stories as I was telling them, with the records, the photos, the interviews, and the various other bits of information that had suddenly, you know, appeared, and most of that happened in pretty strange ways. One was like the chance finding of letters in the back of a cupboard by my cousin in Prague that was written from my grandmother in concentration camp to her mother back in Prague. Her mother was a convert, so she wasn't taken by the Nazis. Then another, like a 95-year-old English guy emailed me. He'd heard I'd been looking for my grandfather's story, and he thought that his teacher, he had this class photo, and he'd found what happened to every person in the class photo except for his teacher. And the teacher had a similar name. He thought it might be my grandfather. So he sent me the photo, and it was clearly my grandfather. So like all these kind of, you know, then the Jewish Museum of Prague was digitizing its records and found a whole lot of records they didn't know they had with my grandfather's name on it, in this secret Nazi project. So all these kind of weird things kept appearing, and I was using them to bounce both. I mean, the book documents my quest, but also with what I found in the recreation of their stories. And I also, you know, when you mentioned before, like, you know, using myth and legend, it's told through kind of a prism of classic Jewish and Czech mythology,
including Kafka. And one can say it is Kafkaesque.
Yes. It's not hard to see that The Trial is my favorite book. Part of the reason being that my grandfather, it was his favorite book, and he kind of gifted me his copy of it when he died. It was actually the bridge that reconnected us when I was a teenager, because we were very close when I was a little kid. We were always close, but we were like particularly close when I was a little kid. And then there's this classic story where he said to my mum, when I was kind of mid-teens, you know, I don't know how to relate to him anymore. Like he's become a person, an adult. And my mom said, well, so try to relate to him as a person or an adult. And he realized that we actually had a lot of the same interests. So he you know, introduced me to The Trial, and, you know, I loved it. And interestingly, I just found that the two texts that most resonated with me with my grandparents' story ended up being The Trial and also the Passover Haggadah, the story of the Exodus. And both of those are very kind of consciously there are conscious nods to them throughout the book, some quite explicit and some a little bit more oblique.
I was really struck by your process of discovery that you went through, almost like a photograph that is, being developed in its chemical bath, and it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer on the one hand, and on the other hand, not so clear, because you also veer into a fair amount of fiction.
That's a great, great metaphor, because the way I think about it, I have my memory of what he was, right? And I knew him very well. I was very close with him. I spent a lot of time with him and with my grandmother as well. So in that sense, I have the image of the original. But then when I kind of was thrown this kind of blind side of having this article published that told a completely different story to the one I thought I knew, I was suddenly left with that blank photographic paper again. And that's exactly how it was. I was literally watching it appear on that paper, and it was a different picture, right? And I think for me, fiction was an important part of, filling gaps and also understanding. I don't think the facts, the records can't give you the kind of the experiential aspect of the dimension, whereas fiction allowed me to really try to understand their experience and them and what it was like for, a lot of the book takes place in preoccupied Prague and then occupied Prague, and then only the last part is during the Holocaust. But through all of their lives, which were very, I think, quite interesting, different, and in their own ways extraordinary lives, I just thought the fiction let me understand what it was like for them to live it. And also, because there were gaps that I couldn't fill, and because I thought it would be disingenuous of me to try and make it out as if there's some sort of that I'm writing some sort of accurate historical record of their lives, I not only wanted to use fiction, but I actually wanted to use kind of magical realism and fable to make it very consciously fiction, so that people could say, this is unmistakably a novel, even though it purports to tell, I guess, the best guess or the best approximation of what actually happened.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that newspaper article in a moment. But first, connecting to what you've just said, the very title, The Book of Dirt, is connected. I mean, there is the legend of the golem. Talk about the title, The Legend of the Golem, and what role that kind of plays in the emotional heart of this story.
I came up with the concept of this Book of Dirt and the title, The Book of Dirt, before I'd written a word. Because when this article was published, and it said that my grandfather had been chosen as the literary curator of Hitler's Museum of the Extinct Race, and I thought, well, that's a pretty extraordinary story. Why wouldn't he have spoken about it? What might he have found when, as this curator of the books for the Museum of the Extinct Race, what might he have found that would have been some extraordinary thing that would silence him? And I came up with this idea that maybe he found a tattered siddur, a prayer book that belonged to the Maharal, who's kind of the great legendary rabbi of Prague from back in the 1600s. And he was the creator of the golem, who is the clay humanoid that was built from the dirt of the banks of the river and given life through prayer and magical incantations. And so in this book that he found, it would be, the book would be hollowed out. There'd be a clump of dirt, and maybe it was the heart of the golem. And that's what he had found. And at the time, I just thought it was kind of it was a cool idea. I loved it, and I was going to kind of pursue it in the book. But it actually became apparent to me as I was writing it as well that the golem legend became kind of a metaphor for what I was doing with my grandparents as well. Because if you use the term dirt in its kind of colloquial sense, and it suddenly, you're talking about gossip and rumor and that sort of stuff. And that's what I was actually hunting down in terms of information on my grandparents. So I kind of see all the various things that I managed to find as being clumps of dirt, which I fashioned together and through words, through writing, was able to give life to my grandparents' characters. So it actually became quite a a much more meaningful metaphor than I had originally intended. At the beginning, it was just for me kind of a cool storytelling device. But it actually became something that really did mean a lot to me. And I actually felt that while I was writing it, that I felt the presence of my grandparents, that I actually had kind of brought them back to life to spend time with them on the page. And, you know, when I kind of wrote the final, you know, word and my and it went off to print, then they kind of returned to dust because they were – it was just like I for a short while was able to reanimate them, and perhaps they now, you know, exist in other people's minds and as they read it.
Oh, that's just a wonderful metaphor. And this is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Australian writer Bram Presser about his novel/memoir, The Book of Dirt. And so now talk about this Museum of the Extinct Race. There was this article about it. It's quite a remarkable thing. You, I guess, assumed that it was true when you read that. And then the whole thing came under severe doubt when you went to Israel trying to actually track down the records. Talk about the winding path that this part of the story took.
Yeah, so it was very interesting. Like, I grew up with, you know, knowledge of this Museum of the Extinct Race. It's kind of the classic Czech Holocaust story. This idea that Hitler had planned a museum that would be an exhibition of what Jewish culture was like in Europe, this decadent, you know, Jewish culture, and that it was basically going to be a place where people would go and say, well, thank Hitler that he managed to extinguish this race, because look at the depravity that it visited upon our society. Anyway, so the article claimed that my grandfather, and I'd never heard this story before, like to me, the story I knew about my grandfather, or thought I knew, was that he had just been a teacher in Theresienstadt, and then he was a teacher in Auschwitz, and then, and actually that's as far as I knew his story went. I actually thought he'd been liberated from Auschwitz. And the article came as quite the shock to me. So I went to Yad Vashem and was told that they didn't really have any records to show me, and that the story sounded pretty fanciful. You know, they'd heard of this Museum of the Extinct Race, but there were no real records of it. And then I went to Beit Terezin, which is also in Israel, which is it's hard to explain. It's on a kibbutz. It's like a commemoration center, a memorial site for the Theresienstadt concentration camp, the Czech concentration camp. And they've got all the records there, and they've got a little exhibition center and what have you. Anyway, the archivist there basically told me that everything in the article didn't stack up, and so it most likely wasn't true. And so I had this kind of double-pronged experience where I was told that both versions of the story that I thought I knew about my grandfather likely wasn't true, and also the story of the Museum of the Extinct Race wasn't true. It then became, through that guy, the British guy who I mentioned, contacted me, who had spent kind of the last 30 years really kind of documenting and bearing witness to his experience. He helped me with a lot of research, as did actually the Jewish Museum of Prague. And we found out about this Talmud Commando, who was this group in Theresienstadt who had been selected. It was a small group of rabbis and scholars who had been selected to sort through the books that had been stolen from around the Reich, the occupied lands. And so it then was more likely that that's what he was part of, and that the Museum of the Extinct Race thing was a bit of a fanciful exaggeration of his story by a slightly over-eager journalist. And so I kept following that lead, and that's what the records that started to appear that the Jewish Museum of Prague found while they were digitizing their archives, all of the names in it, including my grandfather, stacked up to being part of this Talmud Commando, even though on the worksheet it wasn't called a Talmud Commando. It was just called Arbeitsgruppen M, Work Group M. But all the people on it were the right people that I knew there were associations with, and I was able to kind of piece it together. And then as I was speaking with the director of one of the directors of the Jewish Museum of Prague, and she was telling me that, the Museum of the Extinct Race is a kind of a misunderstanding. There actually wasn't such a thing. There were various groups collecting various artifacts and books and what have you, but it wasn't for the purposes of some sort of museum as kind of it's been told and passed on. And this was an idea that came about after the war through, weirdly, a misunderstanding by a journalist of what was explained to them by the first director of the Jewish Museum of Prague, who had actually said, and this is actually why for me I think it's important that we understand that this museum, the extinct race, wasn't a real thing, because it gives credit to the Nazis for something which was actually a brilliant kind of chutzpahdik Jewish idea. The Nazis strangely allowed the workers of the Jewish Museum of Prague to keep the museum open during the occupation. And they became aware very early that there were communities in the outside of the cities that were being extinguished, that were actually being shipped off and killed. And they thought that would end up happening to them too. So they convinced the Nazis to send all the artifacts from all of these communities to Prague, where they would sort it and they would put them on displays in the Prague Museum, the Prague Jewish Museum. And that's what they did. And so they managed to save countless artifacts that otherwise would have been, lost to time. Who knows where they would be. They were all collected together. That was not what my grandfather was part of. That was quite separate from the Talmud commando that was working in Theresienstadt. And those collections were going to be for a representative library that was being set up, where Nazi scholars could learn from the original texts, essentially, about Jewish whatever, faith, philosophy, culture, what have you, from the source, to build their theories about the inferiority of the Jewish race. So I can understand, it makes a lot of sense how the idea of a museum of the extinct race came about, but that isn't what was actually happening.
And yet, in a way, that is precisely what they were doing. I mean, the intention of collecting these books so that they could prove a point, the Nazis allowing that to happen.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. Conceptually, it's actually right. There just wasn't going to be a museum.
And it actually, in some way, kept your grandfather alive, not extinct.
Oh, absolutely.
At least long enough so that, he did miraculously survive.
Well, I think that this is the thing, right? Like, had he not been in the Talmud commando, and in the Talmud commando, he was given, better rations, better sleeping conditions, just better living conditions in Theresienstadt. When he was taken to Auschwitz, he was actually quite healthy. So he spent six weeks in Auschwitz, and he was in the Czech family camp, which is a kind of little known part of Birkenau history, where basically the Nazis had it as their backup plan, where Theresienstadt was their show camp. But if the Red Cross or allies demanded to see any of these camps other than Theresienstadt, they were going to show them the Czech family camp. And so the conditions in the Czech family camp, while still horrific, their heads weren't shaved, they weren't wearing striped pajamas, they weren't gassed, they weren't summarily shot. It was that they lived in filth and squalor, but they lived. Many died from disease, but not through the, active murder that was going on around them. So he was able to be relatively healthy. And by the end of his 6 weeks, he was obviously, quite sick and quite frail or whatever. But had he not had the buffer, I suppose, of health that was given by having been in the Talmud commando, he almost certainly would have died. His brother died. His brother was killed there. The thing with this camp was to make sure that everyone stayed looking healthy. Every I think it was 6 months, they cycled the arrivals, and anyone who, once you've been there 6 months, you were taken off and you were murdered, and a new shipment of people were brought in to make it look like they were healthy people there. But that happened to my grandfather's brother. My grandfather managed to survive until the liquidation of that camp and was taken off to Sachsenhausen in Germany.
Wow. Now, there's a whole other storyline here, which obviously does connect up, because it is the storyline of your grandmother. And so tell us a little bit about her and her mother, why she ended up in the camp and her mother did not. Just kind of give us the overview of that story and how, how did that figure in your voyage of discovery?
So interestingly, at the beginning, I wasn't in the slightest bit even thinking about looking at her story. She didn't even feature in my thoughts of my grandparents as survivors. I just, you know, she was a survivor, but his was always, to me, the more intriguing story. And the article was about my grandfather, not her. So I thought I was pursuing his story. Now, I actually say that I set off to find my grandfather's story, and I ended up writing my great-grandmother's story on my grandmother's side. Like, I think she's the hero of the book. My great-grandmother was not Jewish. Well, she converted to marry my great-grandfather. He was a drunken gambler who basically destroyed the family. And then when the Nazis occupied Prague and they started shipping Jews to Theresienstadt, or deporting them, he was actually theoretically protected by his marriage to my great-grandmother, who was Aryan, by the Nazi standards. But he decided that he would sacrifice himself in the hope that he would protect her and the children. So they basically agreed to divorce. He thought that that would mean he was shipped to Theresienstadt. It turned out that also my grandmother, who was the oldest of four girls, and the next sister, were also, and so all four girls were Mischling, which is like half breed, I suppose, half Jewish. So if you were Mischling over the age of 14, you were also taken. So my great-grandfather, my grandmother, and my great-aunt were taken, and left in Prague was my great-grandmother and my two other great-aunts. So you literally had a family split in half. And what I didn't realize until my cousin, who was my grandmother's youngest sister's son, found these letters, was that they actually stayed in contact. Not only did they stay in contact, the official postcard system that the Nazis had, they were actually smuggling letters and supplies back and forth. And we had these letters to prove it. So suddenly I had this incredible story of this woman whose family had been taken away from her, desperately trying to stay in contact and keep them alive. And on the flip side, within the camp, this 16-year-old girl, my grandmother was 16 at the time, being this incredibly brave young girl, receiving these letters, taking huge risks, having supplies smuggled into her, organizing what needed to be had to make sure that her sister and, to a lesser extent, her father survived. And so that to me was incredible. I'd never really thought. And also, as I learned the various things, like my grandmother was an accidental witness, I suppose, to some really major parts of history as well. Like, I found out that they lived a few doors up from where the paratroopers who assassinated Heydrich initially hid after the assassination before they moved to the church where the siege happened. And so they actually saw, they were there the day that the Gestapo came and raided the house of the person who was hiding them. They'd already escaped by that point. So they were there for that.
Just briefly tell us who Heydrich was.
So Heydrich was the acting Reichsprotector in Czechoslovakia, and he was considered one of the most brutal Nazis there was, and he was Hitler's kind of right-hand man, head of lots of the really like brutal kind of death groups. He was one of the major architects of the Final Solution. He was really one of the nastiest of the Nazis, and Hitler appointed him the Reichsprotector of Czechoslovakia.
When I read that part, I wasn't sure whether this was a fact or fiction. I mean, that is really a remarkable story.
It's unbelievable. And I only found out by accident as well. This is the most amazing part about a lot of writing this book, was how much I sort of found out by accident as opposed to what I was actually searching for. So my cousin, the same one who found the letters, took me to the church where the siege happened, where the paratroopers ended up committing suicide down in the crypts. And I was just reading like on the walls the story of the whole operation to assassinate Heydrich and the reprisals afterwards, and it mentioned the street name where my great-grandmother lived. And I said to him, like, this is the same name. He goes, oh, yeah, they live just a few doors down. I was like, are you serious? Like, he didn't think to tell me this. And so, yeah, this incredible that they witnessed, a major part of the, Czech wartime experience. Actually, arguably part of the major part of the Czech wartime experience. And similarly, she arrived in Birkenau the day before the uprising that destroyed one of the crematoria, the only uprising in the kind of the history of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And she was imprisoned in one of the sub camps that was right next door to where it all happened. So she saw that as well. Like, so I think it's about both my grandparents. I understand why they didn't speak, but gee, I wish I could speak to them now that I know what I know.
Well, that was my final question, actually. Not only did they not speak of this, but you never asked about it. Talk about that, because that's something that you wrestled with, that you hadn't asked the questions.
Yeah, look, it's interesting. Like, I think I was comfortable or content with the versions of the story that I knew. They seemed plausible. I didn't really think about it. My grandparents were pretty clear that they didn't want to talk about it. And I don't know, part of me is a bit, well, not a bit, quite annoyed at myself. They died when I was 19. I had ample time. Part of it's also, you know, to give myself a bit of slack. When you're young and you don't actually quite understand the importance or the magnitude of what it is you're failing to ask. It's something that you probably gain with a bit of age and maturity. And what's interesting, because they chose not to speak, I actually grappled with the question of whether I could tell their stories. And what caused me to ultimately decide I could was that this article had been published, which I was able to discover pretty quickly was for the most part not true. And I didn't think that my grandfather would want the final word about him, because he was a very, you know, well-known and much-loved member of the community here in Melbourne, in Australia. I didn't think that he would want his lasting legacy to be a falsehood. So I thought it was important that I do what I can to get out there what the real story was.
Well, it is a terrific story, Bram Presser, The Book of Dirt. Thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great. Thank you.
Go to writersvoice.net to see images from Bram Presser's family story. Coming up next week, we talk with Rachel Snyder about the epidemic of domestic violence killing so many women in America. Her book is No Visible Bruises. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.